which is an example of, like, if somebody wanted to argue, like, an editing mistake, that's a lot of trouble to move a fucking bear rug. It's a big rug, you know? It's like, and then the Winnie the Pooh sitting there on the floor, and the Winnie the Pooh in the scene where Wendy's watching TV with Danny, and she gets up and she leaves, and you see the little Winnie the Pooh in the corner, but then obviously the bear head that he's sitting on, and the when the psychiatrist is talking to him, or the doctor is talking to him, and kind of makes some slight insinuations about the dad's, you know, abuse. But I don't know. I just thought that that was an interesting way to look at one idea of what could be being communicated by the bear outfit, the man sucking the guy's dick at the end of the film. In the bear costume, and how, I mean, that's like, I mean, awareness test is, it feels really appropriate to me.
Absolutely. I, that was the whole theme I was trying to get at, when I first kind of started my blog, was, there's the snippet in McLuhan's Gutenberg Galaxy where he discusses the film that they show to tribal Africans, that they're trying to educate them on ways to have cleaner water, right? That you need to boil water to destroy, you know, bacterium and stuff. So they show them, you know, like a 5-minute film that walks them through the instructions. And after they see the movie, the only thing they remembered seeing was a chicken.
Right.
And the people who put together the film could not be convinced that a chicken was in any frame of that movie until they slowed it down frame by frame. And sure enough, in less than a second, a chicken scrambles past a corner of the screen that was unintentional.
In your blog, when you talked about that, were you talking about 2001? Did you see The Chicken in 2001, or was it another film? I can't remember what it was.
Well, and also in The Shining, in that The Shining is just loaded.
Did you say that in your blog? I'm just curious.
I think
when you did that, because I remember when you wrote about that.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a while ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago. But it's just that whole notion of print heads look at reality in the way that they're always extracting information from it. They're not looking for beauty or poetry or rhythm. They're always looking for information. So in a print-centric lens, there is no moonwalking bear at all. It's irrelevant. There could be 50 million moonwalking bears, but they don't exist in the mission for the information that one is, you know, set out to define.
Right.
Like, I imagine how many people are able to, like, when the film stopped, I had the 13 number in my head, right? And so it said 13. So, you know, I passed the test for the question that they asked me. But I wonder how many people can get the number 13 accurately.
Can get the number 13 and catch the bear without knowing that the bear is going to slide through the shot, you know?
Yeah,
that's like a rare individual. The person that is able to count while also seeing the bear.
Well, I think that there's something about the second pass, right? Like the second pass through. Like once you establish... Yeah, I don't know how many people are going to be able to see the bear and the 13 in the first pass through. That's a mighty complicated feat, one would assume. But I think that if someone was maybe elevated to a certain state. They might they might not mention the bear.
There was the David Bohm Krishnamurti book, The Ending of Time, where they talk about how they're communicating the absolute rare individual, you know. If we had so many of these, we could, you know, here's Ellen.
Hey.
This isn't very late. I got a message saying you would be a little late in this event.
I said there was a possibility that I would.
So you went for a job interview today?
Yes, yeah, and I actually have another one between 3:30 and 4, so I'll have to skip out possibly a little early if we're still going at that time. Hey, before we have Jay, can I just jump into something real quick?
Sounds good. Sure.
Are you recording this?
I am.
Always, always. Here's the deal. I just got off the phone with Will Morgan, who had to go to work, but he wanted me to share something with you, particularly David. He watched I Heart Huckabees for the first time, and he had listened to you and me talking about it over the last, I don't know, 2 weeks, where we mentioned the whole Wolf Force being the strength card. I don't know if you've ever seen Will's video about the strength card, Beauty and the Beast, and the whole this idea of King Kong, right? Well, he says that in I Heart Huckabees, when he's trying to dismantle, when he's in the bag, he keeps seeing an image of Jessica Lange. And then the other girl in the movie is Naomi Watts. And he says Jessica Lange is the old school, I think, Jeff Bridges King Kong girl. And Naomi Watts is the new Peter Jackson King Kong girl. And then he says that Lily Tomlin was in a movie called The Incredible Shrinking Woman. And he said, if you look at the movie post, you see her being
carried with her with the ape and the roller skates.
Uh-huh.
Totally, wow.
And Marky Mark is Planet of the Apes.
Ooh. Ooh. Ooh, it's so good. Totally.
So he's saying it's all Beauty and the Beast strength card, and he wanted me to drop that on
you. And the way that Schwartzman says... what does he say about the photo? He's like, should I not look at Lang or whatever with her? He keeps looking at the pictures of her. Isn't that her name, Lang? Or am I confused? Okay.
Wow. Jessica Lang, yeah.
But her name isn't Jessica Lang in the movie. I mean, her character. I mean, the...
I don't think Jessica Lang is in the actual movie. He's fascinated with the actress.
I know, but what wasn't her name Lang? Or am I confused? I'm going to look it up. I might be confused. I Heart Huckabees. Huckabees.
Huckabees. She said Huckabees. So there's a small problem. I'm in this new apartment, and it's super echoey in here.
Sounds okay to me.
Bill, how's it sound to you?
It's definitely different, but nothing that's distracting, I don't think.
Okay. Because it's actually raining outside, otherwise I'd take this outside to lose the echo.
We should start the show with Pink Floyd Echoes.
We should start the fucking show with Jay Weiner, but the guy I don't think is going to show.
Really? Again? Wow.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Maybe we're on his shit list.
No. He's just a busy guy, I think.
He was on Vinnie Eastwood yesterday.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Last night he was on Vinnie Eastwood, which is so funny because when we had Vinnie Eastwood on, remember we said, oh, next week we'll be with Jay Widener. And he's like, oh, I've always wanted to interview that guy. I've been meaning to get him on my show. Let me know his contact info. So obviously I didn't send him contact info because we didn't even know if we were actually getting through to Jay. There was this whole weird idea of did he confirm or not and what happened. So I figured let's see if we actually get Jay to come on first and then we know if that actually worked.
Exactly.
So fucking yesterday night I go on Facebook and I see Vinnie Eastwood saying, I'm live with Jay Widener right now. I'm like, what the fuck? So... now it's going to look like we stole his guest instead of the other way around.
Talk show wars, man. They never end.
For real.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that video posted. I think it was on there with him. I was like, I'm kind of wanting to watch it.
The first two and a half minutes are pretty funny to me in the way that it's introduced.
How much did you listen to?
I bounced around here and there. I probably caught about 35 minutes of the whole hour and a half of actual audio.
He laid out this really interesting thing I want to go into with him. I feel like we have more specific things to speak about him with, whether that's Room 237 or his old school alchemy work. But he's taking this position that all the, like, fake stuff in it was Sandy Hook. He's saying, you know, it's not. He's not saying that they're actors necessarily, although he's saying some of them might be. But this idea that this is intentionally poorly put together, so you can see the plot holes, and this is some equally powerful anti-Illuminati or anti-New World Order force that puts on these fake events or put out fake things into the news stream so that you can pick up on what's wrong. It's sort of like intentionally placing flaws or clues so that people can realize that they're being controlled, and then you wake up and you fight the New World Order. But he's saying that these guys are equally powerful, but they're the good guys and they're possibly our saviors, which of course I take issue with. Is, you know, you're going to be you want to fight one control system and let's institute another. These are the actual good ones that we should have leading us, or I don't know. I don't know if that's exactly what he was saying, but there's a lot of issues that I had with that. But it's just very interesting. Just like, I was like, really? Really? That's his position? But okay.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to press him on that as well. Just to kind of, I mean, I guess he was pretty explicit in his explanation to Vinny that, you know, for him, there is a group out there responsible for a lot of chaos in the world. And that once that group gets the power that they're looking for, then all those elements of chaos will disappear by virtue that they started that shit to begin with. So I think he was saying that, you know, the whole abortion issue will disappear. The gay marriage issue will disappear. Hell, even terrorism will disappear because they're the ones that are making that happen. A lot of
movement over there. Is that you, Alan?
Did we lose Alan?
Oh, no, I'm here. Okay. I'm here.
You're like fiddling with stuff.
Yeah, I was moving the computer, and it's just just the whole thing. That was me squirming in my seat, thinking about this control system saving us.
But he doesn't put a name on it, you know. He doesn't have, you know, he can't point the finger. He can point the figure to the effects of the group, but he can't point to a group. And he stopped short of naming what that organization might be, which, you know, ultimately leads us to some sort of James Bond type of script, right? Where J is James Bond and, you know, insert a nefarious group name here.
There's also the idea that the group doesn't have a name. That's why we call it like the Bilderberg Group. Bilderberg's name of the building. Bilderberg is not the name of the group. I mean, Trilateral is one thing, but Bilderberg is nothing. It's just that's where they happen to meet. So what do we call them? You know, do they call themselves anything? I mean, whatever. Groups are for, they're for the control system, right? So people have a place to point their fingers so that you can, like, that's like a methodology of false flag terror, right? Is to always have some place to put the blame, you know, so that you can keep moving.
Keep on trucking.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know. So there's a whole, I mean, if we had Jay for 6 hours, I mean, I might want to dive into some of it just because I think that's ultimately kind of fascinating ball to start to untangle. But I guess what struck me in there is he's saying that there was a point in his life, he uses the phrase coincidences. There was a point in his life where he was tracking these coincidences, whether they be in movies or world events. He mentions JFK and 9/11. He says that he was tracking these coincidences, and there was a point in his life where he thought they were coincidences, aka synchronicities, right? But now he's of the position that this is intentional, controlled, deliberate actions, though not necessarily all nefarious. And it's interesting because obviously I'm trying to walk that very fine line myself, and I'm saying when we find these things, it's very obvious that there's a correlation between events or symbols or whatever. The question is, yes, there's a relationship. What is the nature of that relationship? Are these synchronicities? Is this sympathetic magic? Is this, predictive programming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And I think taking that into his breakdown of Kubrick makes it all the more interesting because here is a guy who's saying, everything that I found in this movie is intentional. This is Kubrick the master putting all this stuff in there. And, you know, I have to wonder, even though Kubrick, as masterful as he might be, to think that he planned everything or that he was without, that any artwork could be without unintentional or unconscious, for lack of a better term, sink seeping into your artwork, I think is naive, in my opinion. And then there's the added thing of course, the interpretation of the viewer. Jason Brera put on Facebook this guy who keeps finding bears hidden in every shot of The Shining, which it's like, no, that's not a fucking bear. Like, here, look at that. I just drew a bear over the screen and you can see how they put in a subliminal bear. It's like, no, you just drew a bear onto it. But it seems so serious. Like, the guy seems like he put like a tremendous amount of work. Do you see all those GIFs and animation showing how at this angle this bear comes into view? And it's like, all right.
But don't you... I took a look at that website, and I've been kind of tracking that Sean fella guy for the last 3 years as I've gotten into Kubrick myself, right? And, you know, when he did the Shone Report YouTube clip, at first you want to say, oh, that's crap. Then you go to your DVD and you listen real closely and they're all there, you know, where you hear that Shone or whatever the fuck it is. It's there. So, you know, he's not making that up. After, like, to get to my point, after looking at how in-depth that mega site is now, that, what is it, 220.com or .org, I have to believe that the subliminal bear stuff is a very smart way of sort of sifting out people on a certain level, right? Like, there's content there that's very intense and complicated, but the bears just kind of prevent anyone he doesn't want to getting too close or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love you, Bill. You give people, you always give people the benefit of the doubt that they're so smart.
It's terrible, yeah, man.
No, it's great. It's great. I love, you have a unique perspective, or one that's very different from mine. Like the whole Jan Urban, I don't think we can say this publicly at this point, and if not, you can always cut it. But you had said to me that you thought perhaps Jan was playing a bit of chess himself, saying, hey, this is the arguments that can be made against psychedelics and Terrence McKenna and all these sorts of things, and you better learn how to stand up to some of this criticism, because if you can't argue with me about it, how are you going to argue with the fundamentalist movement or something like that? And that this was, in a way, this is exactly that same sort of thing of sifting out people or training them for the kinds of arguments they were going to have to prepare for. At this point, you know, I thought, wow, that's brilliant. Maybe that really is what he's doing. And after speaking to him, I don't feel that that's, I don't know, maybe.
Why not, Alan?
Maybe, possibly. Possibly. I'm open to it. I'm open to it, but I feel like if that was the case, I mean, basically, Jon Ervin just played, like, no, 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 I'm not listening. And I don't think that prepares you for anything other than, all right, I'm done talking to you.
Hmm. He knew we were getting close to his agenda. No, I think you're correct, because you've got to look at everything from every angle. I mean, to take this back to chess, that's the thing. As soon as you think you know the obvious move, that's the moment where you need to stop and reevaluate. Because that the most dangerous thing to discover in a game of chess is that shining path, that amazing move, that move that you think that's the move, that there's no other move. That's the, because that might be exactly where your opponent wants you. So when something as anomalous as Jon Ervin's complete 360 or 180, I think it's a 180, it just, I'm hesitant to take it at face value. And with the subliminal bears in that guy, in Sean Fellow's work, when all of a sudden it threatens to completely take over the entire site at one point, where every clip has bear, 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 bear. Like, it took me a while to see the bear in the Shining poster, but it's there, and that's brilliant.
Where's the bear in the Shining poster? Which Shining poster?
The classic yellow one.
Yeah, with the face, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's gorgeous. It's a teddy bear. It's right there. He's without a doubt 100%. It's there.
Okay.
And when you see it, you can't not see it.
Okay.
But the way he just completely, like, in where the dog bear is on his knees in the room, he's showing all these bears that are in the corridor, and I don't get that. Maybe if I'm on some pot brownies, I'll see it. But in waking life.
So are you saying that the bear is the face itself, or? Because, I mean, I'm looking at it. You're saying that the face is like a bear's face? It's not Danny's, or it's not just some spooky face. It's actually a bear?
There's a teddy bear that one can pick up embedded within that poster. Throw the link up here so I can take a look at it. I'll see
sure.
if I can...
Let's see. Okay.
The magic of internet.
Bam!
I mean, I see how, like, the eyes could be, like, bear ears or something.
So the nose, right? Look at the nose.
Yeah.
That's the two eyes of the bear. Now, below, there's the brownish nose extending outwards. And then to the left is, like, a little mouth of a bear. So if you look upper left, that's the upper left cheek. You go to the right by the eyes, that's the other cheek. And then the eyes of Danny become the floppy ears of the bear. It's like a magic eye in 2D, but it's like a cartoonish bear. Whatever. He has a...
I'm really trying to see this.
You know how long I tried to look with the Room 237 for Stanley Kubrick, Airbrush in the Clouds? I couldn't find that.
No, exactly. I can't find that. Like... I feel like at some point this is pareidolia. Like, I know that word gets thrown around, particularly I think it's a criticism against a lot of what we do is people are saying, oh, you can see anything you want to see in it, right? This is either apophenia or pareidolia. And to some extent, I mean, this is true. I think this we had on last week, we had Joe Alexander. He calls his films Apophenia Productions, right? It's totally embracing this. Yes, through whatever lens you want to see something, you're going to see it. Well, whatever lens you want to view through, you can pick that up. You can make that happen. Yes, and there's a way to play with that. At some point, though, to say, here's clouds in the background. And I don't know. But you know
Do you know how this works? I guess if I can clarify the argument being is that if he gets you to look for something that really isn't there, but in the mode for seeing something he wants you to see. So, okay, I spend, you know, 2 hours trying to see the shadow in the clouds of Kubrick, and I just can't see it. I'm like, well, that guy's crazy. But then when
it doesn't mean that it's not there.
well, the point being that when you tax your mind with that kind of doubt for that amount of time, then when they come along and says, well, do you see this? Oh, well, I can see that. That's clearly there. But that's something they would not have seen had they not strained their mind to see the thing that wasn't there.
Right.
So, like,
right.
I come up to you and say, there's a conspiracy. Can you see this? And you go, I don't see it. You're crazy. But then I come to you and say, do you see this? Pointing to you something that's not there. But then when you return to the first thing, oh, I see that now. Like, by submerging them beyond where you want them to be, you can actually get them to actually see what they wouldn't see in the first place.
Yeah. So...
And so... Okay.
Does that make sense? I mean, it's...
Yeah, of course. Of course. It's interesting because... two things. One, I was talking about Magic Eye posters yesterday. There's another weird synchronicity where this morning I was thinking about Yogi Bear, and now as I'm Googling yellow shining poster bear, everything's coming up Yogi Bear for some reason. So there's another sort of weird sync. But there is, you mentioned conspiracy, there's a book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. Are you familiar with that book? It's like an old school... from like the, I think, late 60s, early 70s book where this guy's laying out this like massive, essentially socialist conspiracy, Rockefellers and all this sort of stuff. It's like a really old school conspiracy book. And he gives the introduction to the book is saying, do you remember those puzzles when you were a kid where you have to strain and it says, you know, find the hidden wheelbarrow in this artwork, and you're looking at it and looking at it and looking at it and you just can't see it. And then finally when you see it, you can't unsee it. And you're like, oh my God, right. It's hiding in plain sight. And he's saying that's how conspiracies sort of work, or how this mindset works. And I think it's really accurate. The only, you know, sort of addendum that I think is important to add to that is that not only can you see the wheelbarrow of conspiracy, but you can see the, you know, black hole of synchronicity. You can see the, you know, crescent moon of esoteric, you know, symbolism. You know, whatever you want to find, to a certain extent, whatever you want to find in that, you can, and I think we have to acknowledge that. It doesn't mean, I guess what I keep trying to harp on is to say, is one more true than the other? Is this all, if it's all in our head, well, then all these things are equally true. It's all in your mind, it's all perspective, whatever you bring to it. And then the other side to that is, well, if I'm the illustrator of that thing and I hide a fucking wheelbarrow in it, well, does that make that wheelbarrow any more, quote-unquote, true, or is that the correct hidden image?
Is it more significant because it's hidden?
Yeah.
Does it give it a significance? And that's what I took from one of the meanings of Freud's The Uncanny and applying it to The Shining, is the idea of something becomes uncanny if it's hidden. That's one aspect. Like, if you go and you see something, but you're not quite able to reconcile the meaning of something, you're left with a piece that you just can't quite wrap your mind around. Shortly before you jumped on the line, I had shown Bill a video of demonstrating the hidden bear thing. So there was an awareness test that goes way back where there was these two jugglers, and they would juggle balls back and forth or whatever, and they ask you to count how many times the ball goes back and forth or something like that. And everybody misses the fucking bear that walks behind the balls. And so this was people passing a ball back and forth, and then there's a moonwalking bear. And it was just, that's a classic awareness test, and it was traditionally done with a guy in a bear outfit. And so I thought that was kind of interesting, looking at Kubrick's usage of the bear in that same regard, because that's what you see through those films, but repeatedly things being shifted and changed, but you're not paying attention. But to those, you're paying attention to the storyline. But I was considering also that, you know, you want to be able to catch both, and that just because something's more superficial doesn't mean it's any less significant than the hidden bear, you know. It's just you want to be able to keep a lens that captures the whole scene. And who is the rare individual that comes along, counts how many times the ball went back and forth, and catches the bear without being told there's going to be a moonwalking bear, you know?
So this morning I was walking to this job interview, and there's this theater that I have to walk past. It's like this like convention center, and they have like, oh, this week, you know, they have like the different dates and the different shows. So like Jerry Seinfeld's going to be here on February 22nd and different things, right? So the thing that was closest to the top was a kid's TV show that I'm actually somewhat familiar with called Yo Gabba Gabba.
Oh, that's huge.
Right. So it's YOGABBAGABBA, right? And I'm looking at it, and I had been thinking about yoga, so I'm realizing that the first four letters of the thing are actually yoga. So it's like where it says Yo Gabba Gabba, it's actually yoga. And then, of course, ABBA being like, could be like my last name, but there's also the Crowley Babylon sigil, where he's right.
Did you say ABBA?
Yeah.
ABBA is Hebrew for father.
Right.
Which is why ABBA calls themselves ABBA. There's no question.
And ABBA is mother, I think, in Enochian.
Oh, in John Dee's.
And notice that if you broke up the yoga of Abba Gabba, which of course sounds like abracadabra, it's basically throwing a G in the middle, which is your, you know, is that your Masonic G or whatever you want it to be. It was just interesting that this is how I was looking at it. Again, it doesn't mean that that's it. That's the, you know, the guy who came up with the name Yo Gabba Gabba might not have been hiding yoga father, Masonic G father or something.
Yo,
father. Yeah. Well, there's a thing with the ABBA, Muriel's Wedding. So Muriel is not any traditional name. You can't find that anywhere, but it's symbolic. So you could look at. Have you ever seen Muriel's Wedding? It's not the greatest movie, but it's all just completely loaded with symbolism of the that she wants to get married. It's total Shekinah Zaire playing out in a very direct way, and she's obsessed with ABBA, and she considers herself the dancing queen, and so you have her identifying herself as the queen. But there's levels of it to get into. I've been meaning to watch it again, because this all struck me while I was studying. I was like, Muriel's Wedding, oh shit. And so I went down this whole brief little rabbit hole with that, but I haven't rewatched it. I like how when you put up the Jack the Bear poster, you can see that the J and the B are both highlighted, one blue and one being red. And of course, you have the two pillars of Solomon's Temple immediately coming to mind as the Boaz and the, how you say it, Jachin or something. I don't know how you say that. Is that?
Exactly. Yeah, the red pillar, blue pillar, J and B highlighted. Boaz.
Right, and so then you have the High Priestess immediately comes to mind as well with Gimel.
If you want to go down that Jack the Bear thing, I just want to say, so when I was looking at Yo Gabba Gabba is when I thought about Yogi Bear. I was looking at Yo Gabba Gabba, thinking it was yoga, and I thought about Yogi Bear. So I just think it's funny that all the Google results were Yogi Bear. So if you want to go that Danny DeVito with the High Priestess, I just want to lay on you. I had this thing where Danny DeVito is in the Disney Hercules thing, cartoon, where he is a satyr, he's Pan. So you have him as the goat of Oz, right? That's Oz is the goat, Pan. And then you also have that Danny DeVito was in this movie, he actually, I think, directed the movie, Matilda, which is a Roald Dahl adaptation. And in it, his last name is Wormwood, which of course Wormwood is the falling star that starts Revelation. Yeah.
Wormwood would kill 1/3 of all the plants and animals.
So I connected that to, so if he's Pan, and what's the idea of panspermia, right, is the falling rocks from the sky that would seed life. So the fact that he would be Wormwood and Pan.
Totally. Yeah, he's also, the first thing that comes to my mind when I think of Danny DeVito is, well, A, romancing the stone,
the Fool of the Nile,
and the meaning of romancing the stone once again being our Shekhinah, who's referred to as the stone. You could, the stone that the builders rejected is originally in reference to her. Then you can take it as Jesus, who is also the stone that the builders rejected, that will be the keystone or the stone head of the archway or whatever. But then War of the Roses. He's the attorney in that, but
yeah.
I love at the very end of War of the Roses when it zooms out of Danny DeVito's apartment and you can see a white rose right there. You have the classic painting of the roses red, which I've been tripping on for the longest time, which is just layered in meaning with Princess Di, who's the rose of England's rose. Which was the number one selling song of all time, I believe, was Elton John's version of Candle in the Wind, which is Goodbye, England's Rose.
Yeah.
We also have this white rose as being this symbol of like alchemy or the Rosicrucians. So,
completely.
So painting it red was taking it from the white stage to the red stage of alchemy. But then, there's that. But, I'm sorry. I've been having this weird like Rosicrucian sync thread that I'm not going to drop on you. But that's all I could think about when you said that.
Oh come on, Alan.
Absolutely. No, and the rose itself is held in the cube of space, which is on the cross, and so there's just you could go on forever with the significance of that. There's a whole thing too of. That you have the meaning of Jesus as Christian Rosencrantz, right? And he's the man. You have the tomb itself. There's my favorite book on Rosicrucianism is by Paul Foster Case. It's called The True and Invisible Rosicrucian Order. I loaned it to a friend of mine and he never gave it back. But I have a hard time holding that against somebody because I probably wouldn't want to give that book back either. he goes through the gematria of the two manifestos that Rosicrucianism is based off of, which is the Confessio and the Fama or whatever, if I'm pronouncing that right. And he applies Greek gematria to the text, shows the significance of every little part of it. Highly, highly, highly recommend book. But I can't help but, over and over and over again, especially American Beauty. American Beauty is just completely loaded, and also Eyes Wide Shut. Those two and Tommy are probably the best Rosicrucian films to really dive into, to study the symbolism and apply it to the film, because it's just steeped in it.
Who is the name of the author again? Paul
Foster Case.
All right.
He started the BOTA.
That's been coming up lately. I've been seeing people reference that, or at least I've been recognizing people reference that more.
Yeah, it's interesting. I got way into it. I took a class on it for a couple of years.
Is there a distinction between the BOTA and the OTA?
OTA, this is Builders of the New Adytum, I guess you'd say. So, I don't know. I think that's how you pronounce it. I should know. I spent some time with it, but OTA.
Yeah, I was listening to a lecture about this magician who founded the OTA two nights ago. And then I think that was probably the night that I went to sleep or woke up with the Alice in Wonderland song, You Can Learn a Lot from the Flowers, stuck in my head.
uh,
You know, concerning the Rosicrucian literature, no one really knows who exactly wrote the first two, right? But the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosencrantz, they know, they pretty much know who wrote that. I can't think of the name offhand. It's, I'll think of it. But, and it those things were written originally in Germany, correct? The at least they were, like the Rosicrucian, the Fama, and then the
Those are written in. Those are written in Greek.
But they were they were found in Germany, or they were
they're propagated in German. But yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. I would have to look at it again because I wonder if if they're just make like what they did with the New Testament, where they insist that it was originally written in Aramaic, but that the later versions are Greek. If they have German versions of the manifestos and then say that they're originally written in Greek.
Well, you're right. You're right. They would have been found written in Greek because these texts would have been written, they said, you know, in the 3rd century or something, or the 7th century, whenever they purported him to have lived, right? Because the whole, there was a mythology built into it that was, as they referred to it, as the ludibrium, which was the comic myth that gets people into the door. You know, it's the bells and whistles outside the carnival, but once you're in the carnival, they want to get you off to the side where they can actually give you the real deal, right?
Yeah. And, so, yeah, go ahead.
No, you go for it.
Here's a game I want to play with you guys, if you don't mind. This was something that occurred to me while we were making the drive down to North Carolina. I was listening to the John Lennon song, Oh Yoko. You familiar with that song?
Yep.
Okay. Very simple lyrics, right? It's only a few verses. They're really short, simple things. Now, if you can pull up a copy of the Rosarium Philos... I can't pronounce this shit. You know, the Rosary of the Philosophers. Classic, you know, 20-something images. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You're just talking...
Don't make me try and pronounce this. Rosarium Philos... Oh, God, bastards. Don't make me try and pronounce it. You know...
Yeah, it, I mean...
fuck
yeah,
you.
I have it pulled up.
So, what are you bastards trying to pronounce that? Philosophorum? Philosophorum? I don't know.
I think that's close enough.
So, basically, if you... This is like one of, you know, really classical, foundational stuff here. Now check out the lyrics to O Yoko. Right?
In the middle of the night, I call your name.
Right. So he says, my love will turn you on, right? Well, the first image here is of this fountain.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
So it's like, okay, I'm taking this as turning on this fountain. This link I sent you here, you know, it says this is the fountain of masculine and feminine energy. It's very obvious, you know, how you could break that down into sexual imagery, but just literally turning something on. The next thing he says is, in the middle of a bath, in the middle of the bath, I call your name. Well, that's the fourth image. So what happens is you start with the fountain, then you have the meeting of the alchemical king and queen, then they disrobe in the third image. In the fourth image, they're in the bath, and it's in the bath that they die. So you have image 5, they have sex. Image 6, they essentially die. Image 7, they raise up into the clouds. Image 8 and 9, their souls are, you know, transformed and rained back down into the body. So he says, in the middle of a bath, in the middle of a bath, I'll call your name. Then in the middle of a shave, in the middle of a shave. Then he says, in the middle of a dream, in the middle of a dream. And then he says, in the middle of a cloud, I call your name.
Yeah.
So here you have him going from, you know, this sort of bath into the cloud, and then what comes after that, they become the, you have this alchemical marriage where they become the divine hermaphrodite, or what we might consider the two virgins or the double fantasy.
Yeah.
Does that sort of...
Yes, I dig it. It's so funny, I was thinking that yesterday to Amy, which is kind of weird that you would mention it, but not that weird because, you know, it's great as well. I was just thinking about this morning about how I was trying to find information anywhere I could find it on John Lennon's relationship to Alejandro Jodorowsky during the Holy Mountain, and how he invested $1 million from Apple into the Holy Mountain, and that the film could never have been produced without him. The point at which he jumped in made it all possible, which fucked out. But one of the things that I found, because I translated an article through Google Translate or whatever, because there's hardly anything written in English. And so they referred to Yoko in this article that Jodorowsky referred to Yoko as Lord of the Rings from J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, which is really interesting because I thought about that. And I'm like, wow, the Lord of the Rings is the fucking source of all evil and control. It's like the Dark Lord, right? It's the fucking Lord of the Rings. Also, you could take it as Saturn, because Saturn is the Lord of the Rings. Saturn is the Lord, and he's, the planet is surrounded by rings. And so you could take it that way. And so, I don't know. I just thought that was a weird... weird idea.
Well, you'd have to look at the Holy Mountain and see specifically what role Saturn plays.
Okay.
Isn't she the one that makes all the psychedelic guns?
She makes the toys spreads the propaganda. And she's the one, when you watch the Marilyn Manson sync with Jodorowsky, where it's repeating over and over again, the fucking Eden Eye burned up all the good it's basically
sorry,
you know what I'm talking about? See that, or yeah. Thing
I'm saying that in Holy Mountain, Saturn the one who rides in like on an elephant dressed up like a clown?
Yeah.
And then she comes down and takes it off. So I was just thinking about Rolling Stones' Rock and Roll Circus, where they're all dressed up as clowns and stuff. And at that, Yoko Ono dresses up as the witch. She's the black witch, and John is the magician. But everyone else is dressed up as, like, clowns and circus performers.
Right. Okay, so I got another interesting thing for you here. This gets kind of a little bit complicated. So, you know, in the Holy Mountain, the scene in which... Okay, so George Harrison was going to do the Holy Mountain, except for the fact that he'd have to show his asshole. She was very... didn't want to do... the scene in which he'd be showing his asshole is while he's getting bathed in the alchemical fountain. If you look at the image of the alchemical fountain in your Roseum Philosophorum...
Thank you, David. I love you.
I don't know.
No, that's what I'm saying. Thank you for trying to pronounce it. I don't feel so alone.
Where you have the dove, which is, Columbia, Columbine, moving into the fountain to purify, right? Ace of Cups, right? So they're holding like these lotuses or something. You see that? The couple?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The shape that they form is this mirrored K, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you look here at what I just posted from my blog, you'll see an image from... the imaginary Dr. Prince. Now that is them holding up the Hanged Man card, which is our Heath Ledger Joker character. And then there's this really strange tablet. And this totally got my attention because at the time I was looking at the Serbian letter, which that shape is. And I found on Wikipedia, it was saying that it's derived from the letter shin, doubled against itself. And the letter shin is a very obviously significant letter. It's in the middle of Yehoshua, which is Tetragrammaton with a shin in the center, Jesus. And so it's just, it carries a lot of significance. But what's really weird about it is that it literally means beetle or peaceful frog. And there is this whole thing about the fact that it means beetle because it's the sound that a beetle makes. It's this Z sound. So when children are learning Semitic languages, that's one of the first letters that they actually are taught. And they take it as a beetle. But I thought that was really kind of weird that there's this, I don't know, I was running with that.
You know that Z sound? Do you know that when George Harrison, he's the first Beatle to release a solo album, and it was this electronic album, and he put it out under the label, not Apple, but under the label Zapple.
Really?
Yeah, he added a Z to the front, which of course gives you like Frank Zappa, but it also was Zapple Records. So just adding a Z to the front. And I love that you just connected this to Jesus or Yeshua, because this Rosarium ends, the final image is the risen Christ, where right. John Lennon might say he's now bigger than Jesus.
All right, so here's the other part, okay? You got Heath Ledger as the Hangman, has that writing on his head. Now, you pointed out that Terry Gilliam, who directed said film, Dr. Parnassus, has the same kind of symbol on his head in another movie when he's a crazy preacher, right? Or the crazy man doing the sermon. But what's interesting is that if you watch Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, a film directed by Terry Gilliam, it is a Z that the attorney writes on Hunter S. Thompson's forehead. And he wakes up and first of all, he's like, I just want to cut a little Z in your forehead. And it's kind of weird. But then later on, he has a Z written on his forehead. I can't help but make a comparison there because it's what's written on his forehead. That's like either a hex or something, but, in Dr. Parnassus.
Well, that would be a reference to Zorro, right? The Spanish swordsman, which of course is just like oro in Spanish is gold. So here's the alchemical gold with the Z.
Right. Also, I mean, he's calling it from Gonzo, I believe, is what the Z comes from, is from the middle of well, but from Gonzo was one idea. I mean, I don't know. It's this weird, obscure thing. It's like, a Z? Is of what he says. He looks in the mirror and he goes, a Z? Like, what the fuck? But I don't know. I thought that was interesting that here you have Heath Ledger has this tablet that's very mysterious with this symbol on it. What does the symbol mean? But Zay, pronounced as a Z. And so, I don't know, it's just that one tripped me up. And then the fact that the Holy Mountain connection, that it was John who produced the Holy Mountain, and that here you have that's the alchemical bath that was introduced. That's with that symbol. If you look at the original alchemy, that it's that double K. And then you have KK, which is 1111, which is also 21. If you add, or so, how was it 21? How did I come up with this? There was a whole thing around this. Oh yeah, canine. So okay, this is weird. So shin is literally the canine tooth, right? It means sharp tooth or fang, right? Which is like vampire fang, which is interesting thing to go into, but that if you add K, which is 11 plus 9, you have 21, which is the judgment card in tarot, which is Shin, which is a full circle. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, because yeah. I've played with K9 a lot of times because 9-11, right? K is 11, so the whole like serious connections to 9-11, I've played with that of the canine, and in New York, where they have police dogs, so we have the police dog who died on 9/11. Whose name was Sirius. The only police dog to die on 9/11 was a dog named Sirius. But in New York, they write their canine units. They write it as literally the letter K9. It's like, you know, someone's playing word games or however you want to look at that. Is they don't write canine units. It doesn't say NYPD, CANINE, unit, it says the letter K, the number 9, NYPD K9 unit.
Yeah, that's
so
weird.
He's so Sirius 11-9. The Sirius 11-9 dog died on 9/11.
So how do you like the connection between that and the fact that K921 is Shin, which is judgment?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, it's funny because I'm looking. I was trying to find you. I googled Zorro Z, just the word Zorro and the letter Z to show you the slashing Z. And everything that keeps coming up is apparently some Zorro cartoon where it's Zorro and the Scarlet Whip. It's some red-headed woman in a red outfit with a red whip. And I'm thinking, because I was seeing Scarlet Woman and you just said Judgment, I'm seeing Zorro with the Scarlet Woman and you just said Judgment. I love it.
Antonio Banderas played Zorro in the new Zorro?
It's not that new, but yes, he did, yeah.
Relatively new Zorro.
With Anthony Hopkins.
Okay.
That's kind of loaded, but...
That's interesting. Last night we watched Interview with the Vampire, and I had completely forgotten that Antonio Banderas is like the group of the Illuminati vampires who are like the club in Paris. And during their ritual sacrifice that they perform in plain sight before everybody, but everyone doesn't know what they're looking at, there's this like checkered floor across the whole stage, and it was just so apparent like what they were communicating there. And so I like the idea of Antonio Banderas as Zorro, then connecting him to the vampire, which is the fangs, obviously, the classic vampire fangs that show up, and how I automatically associate Shin with the vampire fangs.
Yeah, and this could be a completely ignorant cultural thing on my part, but you notice that in Holy Mountain, the outfit that Jodorowsky appears in is very similar to the Zorro outfit, which could, like I said, could be some common Mexican...
Well, in El Topo, more so.
Yeah.
That Jodorowsky wears in El Topo is very similar to the Zorro. In fact, I would imagine that character is probably somewhat based on Zorro. I wonder if he ever talked...
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, here, of course, in Zorro, you have Oz, and you also have, I'm now thinking, and we're just sort of like playing here, but I'm now thinking of Zeppelin 4.
Okay, yeah.
Zozo.
Yeah. I have to process that.
Look, I just found, I'm looking at Zorro, and I just found a ring that says Zorro from Sirius Toys, with a Z. Sirius Toys.
Can you put a link?
Sure.
There's also Ring Around the Rosie, just to tie it back to the Rosicrucian. Okay. And that's funny because they say, I know that that's probably not true about the connection between Ring Around the Rosie and the plague, but that was the big thing in Interview with the Vampire, is the plague shows up, and that's how Kirsten Dunst gets taken in as her mom dies of the plague or whatever. Thank you, Masked Man. I'm watching the video now.
Isn't that a reference to Princess Bride?
Masked.
Oh, no, that's... You can never trust a man in a mask.
I had just posted that to one of the posts that Jason Barrera had made about the mirror mask on the Mask of God, and it made me think of Thank You, Mask Man. And, you know, he's a Zorro character. Not sure what it's worth. Put it up there.
Yeah. This day, there was someone put a picture up of Matthew Modine as the Joker, where his face is. And, you know, immediately I see that somebody has commented that he's Jack and Jack and the Beanstalk. There's a Jack and the Beanstalk remake thing or whatever. And I quickly look up Matthew Modine and find that he was Jacob in a film called Jacob about biblical Jacob. And so that's so funny because Jack and the Beanstalk came from the story of Jacob's Ladder. And so he plays.
I never thought about that. That makes perfect sense. Absolutely.
And
was it?
Private Joker, but then Matthew Modine is MM, right? And if you spell out the Hebrew letter Mem in Hebrew, it's spelled with two Mems. And so that's the Hanged Man. The Hanged Man is Mem. And so that ties us right back around to Heath Ledger being the Hanged Man, as well as the Joker, and Matthew Modine being Mem, Hanged Man, and Private Joker. Kind of a little interesting connection there. Also, I watched Sherlock Holmes the other night. Actually, I watched both of them again because they're amazing. Guy Ritchie, Sherlock Holmes. And there's so many things in there that are just absolutely incredible sync-wise. One of them being in the newer one, A Game of Shadows, Robert Downey puts on a dress in disguise to save his friend there, Ihar Huckabee's what's his fucking name?
Jude Law.
And when his lipstick gets smeared, I swear he looks just like the Joker.
I think I remember that
in a very like noteworthy way, like to
yeah,
a high
explicit.
Yeah, and so. There's this whole theme in the movie, then, because of Guy Ritchie's, you know, being married to Madonna, obviously, to MDNA. And then basically, like, you know, obviously the first Sherlock Holmes was just obsessive about its Kabbalistic stuff all throughout it in an extremely blatant way. This one is a little bit more subtle. In that it doesn't put it right out there other than if you know what you're looking at. So when the tower collapses, when Sherlock Holmes is put in the tower, in Game of Shadows and it collapses, it's just very plain to see that we're looking at the tower card, which is Pei. But what's interesting is that before it falls, he gets strung up by this like meat hook. Which immediately, as soon as I see it, I go, oh, Tzadi. Tzadi is not star. I'm right there looking at what I'm looking at. And then there's a reference that's made to fishing, where he says, you know, who's the fisherman and who is fish? Because he's strung up Sherlock Holmes. And at the end, when he boots the that Russian guy off, I think he's Russian in real life. I don't know. The evildoer, when he, you know, goes with him into the water, survives with his oxygen thing. He makes the flip book where the fish eats the fisherman, just to, you know, but.
I've never seen the movie, but presumably this is Moriarty.
Moriarty, I think, goes over a waterfall with.
Right, in the class, I'm saying I've never seen this new movie. So
no, in the
know.
New movie, I think he takes him over the edge of a waterfall, right?
But that's the classic, yeah, that's how he dies in the books as
oh,
well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
So, really interesting, the whole Saudi is not the star issue, where you have the interplay of the emperor, and that you're putting hay in the place. It's like, you say Saudi is not the star, then you're like, well, then, you know, why the emperor and why hay, and brings up this whole issue. But then hay is the Shekinah being the final hay of Tetragrammaton. And so what happens to Shekinah, the emperor, while emperor is also Caesar. Caesar is the word Israel is the same root as Caesar. And so it becomes really interesting being that the Shekinah is Israel, right? Shekinah is likened to Israel. As long as Israel is in exile, the Shekinah is in exile. And so it's just this whole thing. It's all just so, And so I really couldn't help but make this connection of looking at how, I mean, the the lipstick thing of Holmes and how much he looks like the Joker is just crazy. And then the fact obviously have you know, Holmes was the guy in the fucking Batman. And so, I mean, Jason Brera pointed that out at one point, along with some other
things. When I was trying to tell somebody about synchronicity, a friend of my wife's, she showed me this thing where somebody on the internet had put together that in an old Sherlock Holmes story, someone refers to Sherlock Holmes as the Man of Iron. It's just one line in one book where they refer to him as the Man of Iron. And then they're like, wait, so Robert Downey Jr. plays Sherlock Holmes, who's the Man of Iron, and he plays Iron Man. Now, of course, we could take Iron Man to Ozzy Osbourne, right? Wasn't that them? The Iron Man song? No, I don't know.
Black Sabbath, yeah.
Yeah, so that you have that, you have your Oz again, but I'm instead thinking this is, of course, what is iron? Is Mars, no?
Iron is Mars. And so, but then Black Sabbath is the Shekinah once again, because it's the Sabbath. It's the seventh. Seventh is the Shekinah. She's a seventh lower sphero.
But this would be, but it's the Black Sabbath, so it would be like the Black Madonna, presumably.
The Black Madonna is tricky, because that's just because in a region, how are you going to represent Madonna? But black, everyone is black.
Sure. But I mean, I take that as not just regional, but that there's an esoteric subtext to that in how it manifests, no?
Well, there is. I don't know if the fact that we see old statues of Madonna and she's black, that's why. I think it's just because those people are black, you know? But yes. Black Madonna, you could take it that she's the handmaiden that is the Shekinah's replacement, and so she's the.
I actually think especially if you combine those two things, that becomes a, whether intentional or not, that becomes a sort of subtle racist idea that the Black Madonna is the handmaiden or something like that. But I meant it as sort of two sides of the same. The two sides of the same figure. So you have your Madonna of light and your Madonna of darkness. I don't see one being. I know this is this. I'm taking a different view of it, but I see the Black Madonna as an equally important sort of other side of the coin.
Right. It depends on. I mean, you could take this from several different angles. I mean, I'm just emphasizing that when you see a image of a Madonna and she's black, it has no, in my opinion, any significance in and of itself, like other than the fact that these people, that's how they represent her, because that's the region.
Yes, the duly noted. I think that's an excellent point, but I'm not just talking about black skin. Like, there are Madonna statues that are just made of, like, all black rock. Now, I think something like that, is that just an artistic choice, or is that representing something else?
Or isn't it just historical accuracy?
In the case of the black skin, yes.
Right. But, you know, just looking at the esoteric explanation of the Shekinah's placement as Malkut, she has her counterpart, right, who basically becomes a placeholder for her to keep the tree in the position so that the empire can establish itself. That's why Malkut is literally empire. And so this ties us back into King Kong, where you have King Kong climbs the Empire State Building, which is the phallus that's built on the Malkut. So the phallus of the empire has to basically keep her down. So here's your Jessica Lange, Naomi Watts significance in I Heart Huckabees, right? And then she, becomes very symbolic in that light, and you can see how the French philosopher in the film it becomes the handmaiden, and then Naomi Watts becomes the Shekinah. In the grip of the grip of the beast. So it's not the airplane that killed the beast. It was Beauty. And so obviously, Beauty is the Tiferet, which is the air, and as well as the beast, being that the beast is 666, the Babylonian sun square. And so, it's the dualistic side of both the air.
That's what I'm saying here is like, so you notice how like the King Kong has this fascination with the moon. It's very heavily, it shows up in King Kong as the moon, right? So you have this idea, there is no dark side of the Shekinah. It's a matter of fact, it's all dark. My thing is, if you look at it like a yin yang type thing, that feminine energy, is dark in a sense, but it just means it's this sort of interplay between the two polarities.
Well, isn't darkness receptive because it can take in light?
Absolutely, yeah. As is the moon theoretically, right?
From creation, you have it's the darkness that everything actually comes out of, where people look at it like it's light, but no, the light is actually emanating from the darkness, which is a complete mystery. But we're making a distinction between what we mean by darkness and what we mean by light. I mean, the creation, as far as light goes, happens twice. There's let there be light, and then there's the sun. And so there's the light that casts no shadow, and then there's the light that has shadow. One has no opposite, while the other has an opposite. And this is where you have the significance of the way that love is expressed is something that has no opposite in this regard. Love is a transcendent force, right? And that's why everything, this is my argument towards people that want to look at Kabbalah as like this, that in its roots somehow it's completely in like an evil thing or a manipulative thing. While when you look at the text itself or much of the commentary, it always comes back down to this idea of love, which is that has no opposite. And so it doesn't oppose anything. And so, it's what's there before everything and it's what's there after, right? So, it's the one consistent factor in the midst of change, right? So you can take that as the Shekinah. So no matter how much you repress the receptive energy or force or use it for other means, it's still there and will find its way back to its starting point no matter what we do with it.
You know, can I just I don't mean to take this in another direction, but you mentioned the whole tower card. It occurred to me, you guys know I've been going through some sort of weird ego death ritual over the past month or so, playing out some really weird archetypes or really actually rather explicit architecture is sort of playing out around me. And I'm in Asheville now. We came here for a few days just to scope out the town, try and find a job and try and find an apartment and stuff like that. Well, our first day here, we're walking in this one street and this is all like taped off, like police line, do not cross. And we couldn't figure out what had happened, but it's like two block area that was like closed off. And just got like the newspaper. And it's talking about there was this building in just a few blocks from where I live. The day I came to town, that building, the whole building fell down. So I'm seeing this as, the tower fell.
Wait a minute. You're in New York.
No. In Asheville. It's a much smaller building. It's not like I'm talking about Asheville. The day I came to Asheville, a building, and this is a small town. I mean, it's a small, small town. So when I'm saying, like, everything's a few blocks around, this building in the heart of it just fell down the day I came to town.
Oh, God. That's kind of ridiculous.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It is so, it's ridiculously, explicitly, man, I don't fucking know, man.
No, it's I think it takes a little bit to sink in sometimes, but Ha. But, you know, yeah, that's kind of ridiculous. What was the name of the building? Did you catch that?
There was an address. I think it was like 15 Carolina Lane or something like that. I don't know if there was a name of the building. I can look into it for you.
Well, I mean, you are in Asheville.
Oh, right? Yeah.
So there's something kind of...
Phoenix-y.
Yeah. And I just rewatched Lars von Trier's Dogville the other day.
Okay.
Have you ever seen that film?
I've actually never seen it, no.
I love
it. It's as good a fucking story or movie as there ever was. It made me physically ill, man. I mean, physically just destroyed by watching that film. And the scene with her and James Caan in the limousine at the end is perfect. The tone of that scene could have destroyed everything that led up to it, but it's perfect. And I was not prepared for the way he rolls the credits. I mean, that took major balls to do in 2004. I think with some years removed from 9/11, I think its transcendent and timeless qualities are probably more apparent to more impressionable viewers, you know? I think they could be able to watch it for what it really is. But to release that movie when he released it is just fucking, that's bravery.
Yeah.
You know, I was having a discussion about, is there any dangerous fiction that has gone mainstream? Or is there any dangerous art that is out there? And I just don't know where it is right now. But that film definitely qualifies. That's just gorgeous filmmaking. I'm wondering if you're in your own Dogville right now, Alan.
Alan, he's not gonna like that. I mean, the thing with that film is that she's basically being held in submission, right? Like she wants nothing more but to forgive and release everybody, and just, you know, she was in a position of power that she didn't want to be in. And so she's extending herself to these people, being like, I'm here for you. And so he's not subtle at all with his symbolism. When she's in the back truck with the snakes and the apples, you know, there's no mistake there. She's the fallen. She's a face of Eve, right? And so when she finally is just like, well, fuck it. Fuck these people. Kill them all. You know, that's a little bit different from... from our friend Alan's position.
Well, no. Let me put it this way. I guess this is...
Wait, can I actually stop you there? Because, I mean, I've never seen this movie, but to say, all right, I had this job interview this morning, and it was at this place that I noticed the other day. So there's like this spiritual shop, and they have out front two large blow-up images of the Rider-Waite cards, specifically the Wheel of Fortune and Strength, which, of course, you guys have seen what I'm doing with Suicide Kings. It's basically all about those two cards, right? And that's why I keep coming back to those two cards specifically. So it's like right out front, and I was like, wow, that's beautiful, and it's really cool. Then this ad comes up on Craigslist that this place is looking, and I go to the address, and that's it. The women that I interviewed with both have L names. I'm not going to give their names, but they were both L names, and I'm immediately thinking of LL, the Lilith, right? The sort of Lamed. So when you say this serpent and the apple woman in this town, I mean, that's what I just interviewed with today.
Whoa. Okay. Wow. I was kind of disturbed by the ending of Dogville, and I think it added to it because I watched it with Amy, and she's kind of sensitive to those kind of things. Although she was bored as anything for much of that movie, I think just because it's presented as a play. And if you see a play like that, you generally want to see it live, you know. Although I don't know how, if it could represent that live nearly to the same degree that you get when you watch it as a film. But he has a repeated message that he's communicating, Lars von Trier. And Dogville is basically the same exact story as Antichrist and the same exact story as Melancholia. But the way that it's the same story is not at all obvious, unless if you recognize the repeated usage of the symbolism. Like, you know how with drama you can kind of like find the same kind of dynamics or layout being repeated. He makes quite a bit of variation, but he's dealing with the same exact not subject matter, but the same exact archetypal usage of symbols. And so you can see the, you know, Kirsten Dunst and Melancholia is basically Nicole Kidman in Dogville. Dogville is like a super important piece for all we're talking about here. I mean, we're talking about here the canine tooth and 9/11 and all of this. And she, of course, is our Alice in Wonderland and Eyes Wide Shut, you know, and it's, you know, I like how David Icke wrote a book called, what is it, 9/11 and what is it, the Two Towers and Alice in Wonderland. He makes a comparison through the whole book between Alice in Wonderland and the 9/11 happening. And
really?
So I don't.
Yeah, really. I have to find this because I was going to break down a lot of the Alice in Wonderland stuff in 9/11, but I don't want to repeat.
He came out shortly after 9/11. He was definitely on it. I mean, I don't agree with everything he says, and I wonder how fact-based a lot of his stuff is, but at the same time, you know, it's fucking interesting. I read
that's,
it.
That's just it. I don't know. It's weird. Like, I don't know if we are... Yeah, without... Do people realize they're practicing synchromysticism is, I guess, what I'm getting at. Like, to find Alice in Wonderland in 9/11, does that mean someone put it there? You know, like, the problem is, you know, people connect Alice in Wonderland to, like, MKUltra or some shit like that. So it's this is in there. But I have to wonder, like, when people are breaking down this sort of symbolism or correspondences between events and these esoteric concepts, do they realize, like, if you're coming at it from a conspiracy mindset, you're going to find it as evidence of something, which I don't know that it actually is evidence of anything. I mean, the days that I doubt the value of our work is, I don't know if this is evidence of anything other than that our, you know, we can play mind games. You know, someone, what I was thinking about this morning, the reason I think about yoga is, someone said the root of the word yoga is like yoke, like to bend or this sort of stuff. So when someone makes the connection that, like, by what synchromysticism is essentially a form of mental yoga where you're sort of bending these things together, where someone goes, oh, that's a stretch. I don't know about that correspondence. Uh-huh. It's actually a stretch. It's like, yes, this is a form of yoga. You're stretching your mind to include other possibilities. And I think that was either Jay Kotze or Peg Carter. I honestly don't remember who it was, but one of them made that point. And is what I was thinking about this morning. So this is how I got on this whole idea of like a mental yoga. And I have to wonder, so I guess my point is like, hey, we're getting really flexible with our mind, but every now and then the doubt seeps in, like, is there anything to, like, what are we doing here? And so I'm doubting even every now and then the validity of our work. And I'm, of course, you know, something crazy happens and I'm like, oh, okay, that's right, that's why we're doing it. But, you know, you look at someone like the whole Sandy Hook stuff, or, you know, hearing Jay Widener talk about Sandy Hook last night, it's no different to say it's a positive conspiracy than to say it's a negative conspiracy. As long as you're saying, yeah, there's people out there who are they made sure that the word Sandy Hook was in Batman. Like, really? I don't know. I don't know how, like, it's possible, but it just, I keep, the whole Sandy Hook thing, I keep coming back to the idea that if, you know, the Sandy Hook in Batman is something we would throw out as, like, a one-off in one of these conversations. Oh, did you notice in this movie the blah blah blah? And then we move on. Like, it's not worth building entire websites and devoting entire Facebook groups, and 5 months later, you know, hey, we're still breaking down the evil Illuminati plot of putting the word Sandy Hook in Batman. Like, really, it's not even that good of a sink.
That's what you keep saying, and I couldn't agree more. It feels like a lot of it is just like word games or associations, and you're just playing around with ideas. And a lot of it is like the ideas, the conclusion's already there, and we're finding evidence to back up the conclusion, which is completely backwards to how you're supposed to approach the scientific method, right? But then shit will end up, there'll be examples of things that are just like, well, really? Like, so, and they just make you stop. And so I can't help but feel like there's something to it because that happened. And so whatever, you know, this is what we're doing. This is how we're doing it. You know, so be it, you know? So I, you know, like I keep saying, I just do my best to try and keep things in perspective and to be open to other possibilities. And that's what I feel like is kind of, at least as far as I'm concerned, that's my mission statement with what we're doing and with the show, you know? And so, like, I was thinking about somebody not having something completely fact-based, but that's only when they're presenting it as if it were. Like, if they're arguing that this is what it is, then...
Right, right. I mean, listen, we're still talking about the Sandy Hook thing every now and then. It keeps coming up, but it's coming up in the context of what's, you know, what does it mean, or blah, blah, blah. I'm with you. Yeah. Ultimately, it's the only way I feel comfortable handling any of this work is, like, to say, I don't know. Let's entertain these possibilities. Let's try it out. Let's think it through. It's sort of, you know, you had the chess analogy. How do you play chess? You have to play out the game in your mind. While you're playing, in your mind, you're saying, well, if I do this, they'll do this, so on, so on, so on. You're entertaining an idea and seeing, if I go down that road, what is the likely outcome of such and such? And sometimes it's reverse engineering, sometimes it's forward engineering, but you're trying to figure out, the, you know, you're entertaining these ideas. But if you... You know, to get out there and commit to one thing and say, it is this. Like, I'm not going out there saying, it's definitely synchronicity. I feel like it, that seems like it probably is, but I don't know. And,
But, you know, okay, so we're on this whole level of that. There's no such thing as coincidence because it's all meaningful, meaning it's all synchronicity. But it's... Sometimes you can project your own meaning into the meaningful coincidence. So you're looking for something so badly that you're projecting into this event, into this coincidence, something that isn't there. You know, it's what meaning are you extracting out of the coincidence? So that is to practice the art of synchromysticism. The thing is that people who are not excelled in that art form don't know when they're projecting their own self into the thing, right? That's when you have to take a step back and be able to have a rational conversation about the meanings that you're drawing out. And if someone immediately shuts you down as being threatened because you're saying, I think you're projecting your own self into this meaning, if they reject you or if they get threatened by that, that's almost like your proof right there.
Yeah.
Because if you really think that you're drawing something out of the ether through synchromysticism, you could say, you think I'm wrong? Let's take a look at it. Let's take a look at it together and see where maybe I've gotten wrong. That's when you know or you feel comfortable that somebody is truly looking for what do we see in the crystal ball. And that just brings it to a human level, you know. just the conversational tone, just the feeling you get when you're looking into the crystal ball together. And, you know, I've looked into the evidence of the Sandy Hook thing and the meanings that people are drawing out of it. I'm like, well, couldn't you have gotten that meaning out of 9/11? Or couldn't you have gotten that meaning out of JFK? Yeah, there are people who have a lot more power and a lot more control over you. They have control over the media. They have control over the government. Their fingers are in everything that fingers can be in with power, money, and control. And so if this is a revelation to you now that Sandy Hook happened, well, then you're just like the two-year-old who gets surprised every time the jack-in-the-box pops out a clown. You know, you're just sitting there in your room, just surprised. You're getting surprised like a two-year-old. You're getting surprised at the wrong element. And so when I say, when I get frustrated with it or exhausted with it, it's just that I guess I should just elevate that exhaustion into just saying, all right, I've had enough. I'm not going to be a part of that conversation anymore. And just to just drop out of it completely.